sound.
Two guys with no credentials.
Reviewing Rolling Stone 500.
Greatest album.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us again here on the SoundLogic podcast. And today we're discussing album number 87 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 greatest albums list. This is Bitches Brew by Miles Davis.
If you know anything about Mike and I, you know that we enjoy quality craft beer. And something I knew from being a fan of Dogfish Head was that back in the day, Bitches Brew was a beer that they made inspired by Miles Davis. So knowing that this episode was on the horizon, I asked around to some fellow beer nerds and said, hey, does anyone know where I could get a bottle of Bitches Brew? Well, that was at the point where I realized it's been discontinued. They no longer make it. But one of my disc golfing buddies said, actually, I've got a friend who's got a massive beer cellar. He's a fan of Dogfish Head, and he collects stuff. I bet he's got some. Let me get in touch. Before I know it, he's sending me a picture with multiple bottles of Bitches Brew and said, how many do you want? And I was like, whoa, this is amazing. How much does he want for it? And he's like, no. He's just a fan of jazz and a fan of anyone talking about music, a trumpet player, and he just wants you to have it for the podcast. So all that said, we get to hang out with Nick Raya here tonight. Nick is an officer, a police officer here in central Pennsylvania, and a huge beer nerd. He's actually sitting in his beer cellar right now as we record. Did I get that right, that you play trumpet as well, Nick?
Yeah, that's true. I actually still play in for the military.
Okay.
A lot of people don't know the Pennsylvania Army National Guard has its own band.
No way.
I've been in the military a little over 20 years now, playing in the band for most of it. Brief stint as a machine gunner in a helicopter in Iraq, but other than that, playing the trumpet for probably 19 of the 20 years. So
wow, and a fan of jazz and a fan of this album. Is that all fair to say?
It's fair to say that I'm a fan of jazz. You know, I think you can't really be a trumpet player without at least knowing a little bit about jazz. I actually, when I was in high school, I took a lesson with Maynard Ferguson. You may or may not know him, but he's of Rocky fame, the Gonna Fly Now, the theme from Rocky. That was him and his band. So just a screamer.
Huh, no way.
So I had the privilege of sitting down and taking a private lesson with him when I was in high school. But this is the first time I've ever listened to this album.
Okay.
So to say I'm a fan of this album, it was interesting. It was definitely interesting listen. Very different. This is definitely more like a jazz fusion kind of deal. It was interesting.
So you passed on a couple bottles. I took those bottles up with me at Christmas time and sat at Mike's kitchen table with a good friend of ours. We put Bitches Brew on the record and cracked open these beers. Dogfish Head talks about a sort of the, like being inspired by the album led to the beer for them. Understanding that kind of Bitches Brew, he says there's a spirit of innovation, of creativity, and of individuality that's at the core of Miles's music. And that sort of went in then to creating a beer that sort of goes along with it. So it's this like really intense, dark, but not just like roasty. It's got a whole bunch of different flavors going on and a lot of dissonance, a lot of like going in multiple directions. And we've got the first taste of the beer and then the first taste of the album. And it was just like, whoa, there's a lot going on here. There were a couple points, Mike, I seem to remember where it was like, what, we got to stop here and just like count the senses that we're experiencing. Like, what, not only is the music kind of going all different directions, this beer is too. So I want to say thanks, Nick, for providing that for us, that opportunity. Really, really cool. I guess having Bitches Brew in your collection, you would have experienced the beer a couple times before ever putting on the album.
Yeah, I had it when it's still in regular rotation. I've always really enjoyed it, so I always snatched some up when they released it, and you know, just
tucked it away.
It's stock a few away for a rainy day. And, you know, you never know when it's going to come out. And here we go.
Here we go.
And work.
When did it stop? Do you know?
I think probably the ones that I gave you were the last year they did it. That was okay. 2018. I don't know that they did it after that.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. Well, I've got a barrel-aged stout that I brewed myself here tonight. It's not quite as complex as Bitches Brew, but it's 12% and we've got a lot going on. So I'm enjoying sipping it away. Cheers. Yeah. We've got some interesting stuff to talk about. I don't know if it sounds different for our regular listeners, but our regular recording method didn't work. We're switching to Zoom tonight. So if we happen to talk over each other, editing might be a little bit different, but I think we'll still get something really good out of this. And thanks, Nick, for being here with us and for taking the time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
What do you think? Should we dive into some details?
I think it's appropriate to do that now.
Details, 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 details.
So Bitches Brew was released March 30th, 1970, so almost from the time this is coming out, about 53 years ago. This is, according to the list I looked at, Davis's 42nd studio album.
That's amazing.
In about 20 years. I think his first release was in 1951. So that's an average of more than 2 a year. I don't even know what to say about that. All tracks composed and led by Miles Davis. We might get into that a little bit more, what that means. Charted not great, 71 in the UK, 35 in the US, and number 4 on the Billboard R&B charts. Not even number 1 on the R&B chart. Eventually, it has sold 1 million copies in the US. I think worldwide, maybe 1.1 million. So still not astronomical numbers. Pretty good for a fusion jazz album, I would say. So this is a follow-up album to the previous album, which was called In a Silent Way from 69. And it marked his continuing experimentation with electric instruments that he had featured on that album. So this is the beginning of what you would call his electric period, or just him just becoming more electric. You hear that with some of the recording stuff, the echoes, electric guitar, keyboards, it's all there. In 1976, so 6 years after it came out, became Davis's first gold album to be certified by the Recording Industry Association of America. So it went gold in 6 years. It also pioneered the application of the studio itself as a musical instrument. So Miles and his producer, Teo Machero, I hope I'm saying that right, or close, used the recording studio in radical new ways using special effects, tape loops, tape delays, reverb chambers, and echo effects. Things that had not been used much at all, and certainly not in traditional jazz music. In 1971, it won the Grammy Award for Best Large Jazz Ensemble Album. And as usual with Davis recording sessions during this period, tracks were recorded in sections, which I don't even know how you do that with there's no really any breaks. So Davis gave a few instructions ahead of time, you know, a tempo count, a few chords or a hint of a melody, suggestions to a mood or tone. And Miles Davis liked to work this way. He thought it forced musicians to pay close attention to one another, to their own performances, or to his own cues, which could change at any moment. And I think it's in the title track that you can hear at different points him shouting different instructions or snapping, clapping out a tie change or saying, okay, this, you know, do this now. They've left some of that in, which is really cool. So that's kind of... It's just a bit of background on how they made it. I was reading that he rented some studio space for the week before they recorded. So I think recording was about 3 days. But before that, he rented space for a week. And just 3 hours a day. It wasn't a marathon. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. every day, the group assembled in the studio. No, like he was... a pretty well-known figure, but no media allowed in, no photographers, nothing. Just the band, just the producer. They'd sit in a semicircle with Miles at the middle, and he directed them. And he was very much the director, orchestrator of this whole thing, even though he gave everyone very much free range to work within the loose parameters he set. He was still very much in charge. And I think in general, and I'm not a Miles Davis expert, but, you know, he was creative, but also had a pretty big ego and, you know, was always trying to push the envelope. But at the same time, he's giving people free rein to experiment and improvise on the fly within kind of this loose framework and very loose framework that he's given. And then you get this kind of brilliant masterpiece, as someone call it, out of it. It really, really interesting. It just still blows my mind that you can make something cohesive in that environment. Obviously, you can. Nick, I'm curious of your impressions, you know, as a jazz enthusiast, as a trumpet player, and I assume somewhat familiar with some of Miles' stuff. How do you feel about this concept? And we're kind of jumping right into the meat and bones of this music. If you're not familiar with it, you need to go check it out. It's different than conventional jazz and conventional music, really. How do you feel about this?
It's not for the faint of heart either. That's for sure. Someone who's not really big into jazz, man, it is a challenge to just dive in. But that's a great question, Mike. I'd love to hear.
Well, the question is, Nick, how do you feel in listening to this about this idea of a very loose structure and allowing everyone to do their own thing? Especially, you know, you're in a military band, you know, marching music is extremely structured, extremely rigorous. Everybody, you know, there's no improvisation at all, and this music is the opposite. So I'm just curious of your take on all that, listening to this.
Yeah, and so that's a great question, and one of the things I will kind of highlight just to shed some light on what the military bands do is that we do all the typical march stuff for sure, and the big ceremonies, but we also have a jazz ensemble that we all play in, so... but it's more the typical big band era stuff, or the more... Yeah. Not this, right?
Standards.
We're not doing any like 20-minute odysseys into like, wild stuff. So we do. There is room for improv for sure.
Cool.
There's a bunch of other little smaller ensembles that we break out into where there is a lot of improv. So it's not something that's totally foreign in the military band world.
Okay.
But it's nothing like this. But I think the structure and the most impressive thing for me to listen to in this album is just that loose, bare bones framework of just saying, hey, this is an idea and we're going to go. And that's just such a, I think, testament to the skill of the musicians in the room. And the sheer, you know, I started doing some digging into the history of the album after you asked me to be on, and I listened to it for the first time, and just the sheer number of musicians involved is staggering. And the fact that it was recorded over the course of 3 days, which is crazy. And you know, modern times albums, it's unheard of to record an album in 3 days. And I think it was a span of just a few hours a day too. So that's just, it's such a testament to the skill level of all the musicians in the room to be able to listen to one another, listen to Miles, take cues from Miles, and kind of latch onto these, you know, kind of kernels of ideas for melodies or a direction they want to take the song, and just build upon it and build upon it and build upon it and play off each other. It's really cool to listen to.
A very famous quote from Miles Davis is, I think, when they were performing one night and he wasn't pleased with the band's performance, he said, I don't pay you to play what you know, I pay you to play what you don't know. and that is like, that is this. He said he didn't want anything written down, he didn't want a score, he handed out, you know, very simple, some chord progressions and maybe a few ideas here and there for different melodies, and said, as long as you work in this framework, you do whatever you want. And that, to me, I'm not even, I don't think that you could even call me an amateur musician. Both Ben and I play different instruments, sing, have done things, understand music, but this is just so far beyond me to be able to have it come out as something even remotely cohesive. It's just fantastic and mind-blowing. It's quite a journey to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely. And anybody taking music lessons, learn your scales. Right. that's what it all comes down to.
There's scales in this music.
I'd love to talk before we get too deep in the music about the album cover, because like the sort of experimental category pushing beer and experimental category pushing album, this cover is really trippy and stretching as well. It's also got some dissonance going on in it. What do you guys think about this?
I think it's super interesting. And one of the other things that I learned in kind of reading up on this album to prepare for this after listening to it is just the pushback that there was just over using bitches in the name.
There's
a lot of pushback at that time, which makes sense. It was a... Mm-hmm. tend to be a far more conservative time. People probably wouldn't bat an eye to that nowadays, but there was a lot of pushback from the label and producers on even wanting to include that as the name. So it's just kind of bold choices all around, the bright colors and kind of trippy psychedelic feel to it, which is fitting with the music for sure.
I found a quote from the artist. The name is Malti Klarwein, I think, a German artist, surrealist painter, and he seemed to really be inspired by the album. He would listen to it and then sort of paint, get inspired by it, and he talks about while it's easy to see how the cover might represent dichotomies, it's really more about tandems and shared experiences, coupled with the acknowledgement that individual perspectives can create an otherworldly experience. So I don't know if that's like drawing on jazz specifically, but like, you know, it's easy to point to this as like one person's greatness, but that totally misses what you were saying, Nick, about just how many people were involved, what all is going on, and that it is a relationship when you come together to put something like this together. It's interesting that the album cover sort of reflects that too.
Say above the title, Directions in Music by Miles Davis.
Yeah.
It's a tiny little byline just above the title. And there's so much to me, but really the tandem, the tension, the one individual's hair going, merging with the sky. It's absolutely brilliant. Fits with the music so well. Yeah, that psychedelic feel a little bit. Strong, Miles Davis was, I think, very outspoken with his political views, his racial views. Were quite controversial at times, and these strong African figures on the front too would have been very poignant at the time as well. Yeah. And it's just it's all very striking. I remember my first time listening to this was just a few years ago. I just got my record player, and my buddy Rob, who's been on the show before, said, "We got to go to my parents' place. They've got," and my mom loves like R&B and jazz and all this stuff. I said, "Okay." So we went up, and she had all these crates, and we sat on the floor, and his parents just sat there commenting on them. Oh, we saw them here and this and that and on every album. And we took a few. One of them was Bitches Brew. Came back and threw it on, and I had no idea what I was getting into. not a clue, but I remember seeing the album going, whoa, like just being drawn into like this is surely to be something special. Like, you ever see an album cover and go think like that inspires you to listen to it just by the art? And that was what happened with me. Yeah. Here, and I mean, it wasn't what I expected, but I certainly wasn't disappointed by it being something fantastic.
yeah. Where do you want to go from here, Mike? You're starting to get into some of how you experience the music. Should we talk about that for a little bit?
I mean, that whole freeform thing. I found this. You know, I'm into jazz. I do like jazz. I've listened to a lot of different types. I'm certainly not an expert by any means, but I found it very challenging. And I found myself a little lost when there wasn't as much consistent rhythm. When you get into Spanish key, you get more of a rock feel, and I found that one just easier too. But the other ones, you know, Pharaoh's Dance and Bitches Brew, you know, I found myself a little lost. And as much as there's improvisation and some of it's very free form, there's also structure there, but I felt that it was so just over my head, a lot of it, in terms of technique and you know, the chord structures. I know these guys are absolute masters. I mean, the late Chick Corea, I can't believe he's been gone almost 2 years. I feel like it was just last year. On here, another guy's on it. It's just so far beyond anything I regularly listen to, any conventional music. And I still don't even really know what to make of it. It's something we interviewed Jason Crane for a previous Miles Davis album, and he said something which was really helpful, because sometimes I found myself feeling inadequate when I listen to music like this. And he said the best thing to do if you want to listen to jazz is just know there's no password, there's no secret code. You don't have to have, you know, a degree or a certification or be played for this many years. You can just come and experience it. And those who want to say that are just trying to gatekeep and keep it for themselves. And I kept trying to tell that to myself when I listened to this, because I found myself just being lost and going, I don't understand this. I'm trying to come back to not trying to understand it, just trying to experience it. I say that, but still it was hard. it was challenging. And I feel lost when I can't find a melody or I can't find a rhythm to grab onto. So I think personally, I would need some more time with this. I need to listen to this a few more times to really just find a place where I'm comfortable just allowing it to wash over me. Even as background music, I found it distracting, because there's so many things that kind of like a pin pricking you when you're not expecting it, like this, you know, random note that doesn't fit any chord at all.
Yeah.
It was so that's kind of my take on it in a nutshell. Like I said, the most comfortable tunes for me were the ones that slide closer to conventional rhythms and conventional melodies. But other than that, it was very challenging. I guess that's the best way I can put it.
Makes me think of beer culture too, right? Like craft beer nerds can be gatekeepers as well. And yeah, they like turn their nose up at the people who enjoy an easy drinking, you know, Bud Light or something like that. It's like, that's not real beer. That's not real jazz unless you can't find the melody or can't find the time signature.
Right, yeah.
And yeah, you're right. There is something really profound about that quote from Jason that you really should be able to find yourself in music, in great music especially. Even if you don't understand it, you should be able to feel something, resonate with it. And I think what this music does for me is it reminds me of how rooted and grounded I am in the things that I like. When I get face to face with something like this that is so far outside that, I almost don't know what to do with it. And I feel like somewhat conservative or traditional in that, like, oh, I am fairly committed to the things that I like. I'm not as open-minded or as experimental as I sometimes think of myself when I'm challenged by something like this. And it makes me sort of reevaluate, you know, okay, well, what is it about the other albums that I, you know, I can remember the sort of needle drop on Stevie Wonder's Inner Visions and just like immediately just feeling like, oh, I'm home. This is my music. How have I been missing this my whole life? It just like grabbed me right away. And this, I'd be like, oh, we're still in track one? How long has this been playing? You know, what? I still don't know where I am. What is going on? It's discombobulating, I guess.
Right.
And why is that? And why is some music do that to me? And why not others? And I guess a moment to pause a little bit to slow down a little bit and think, you know, we're all different We're all going to experience things differently, and not to take it too seriously when I think I know what is great compared to someone else. Now, that's a lot of rambling by two guys who don't really know what they're talking about. Mick, do you have anything to add there?
Well, hey, listen, I am by no means any type of a jazz expert in any way, but I would agree completely. But I think it's for good reason. You know, like, there's a reason that 95% of the music ever made follows a pretty similar structure, right? Like, it's easily digestible and people enjoy it. Like, so people are, it's easier to write, it's easier to listen to. That's what people want to hear. So I think there's no shame in saying, hey, we're all kind of in this little, it's not really a bubble because it's a pretty huge bubble, right? Of the same song structures loosely. You know, you know, there's a big difference between like Pink Floyd and Taylor Swift, but you know, it's all still in that same wheelhouse of like a very, you know, there's a melody there. There's a progression. The song, there's a clear beginning, there's a clear chorus, there's a clear, you know, so this is different, and I don't think there's anything wrong with not knowing how to feel about it, right? I think that's kind of the point. I think that's why Miles and these guys did this, is and I would be willing to bet that it was never, you know, Pharaoh's Dance was never performed the same way twice. I guarantee you. Like, it's never when they were out playing live somewhere and they're like, hey, we're going to do Pharaoh's Dance. It's a totally different song. You'd never probably, you could love this album and probably not recognize it here in Atlanta. because that's, I mean, that's just the nature of what they were doing. Everything, it was new and different every time, however they were feeling and however they wanted to play. And you know, you keep that loose framework, but things are constantly changing and evolving based off who you're playing with. So for me, it was, I approached it less of like this, I need to understand what's happening, and I just kind of wanted to hear it for what it is and let it do its thing, right? I don't know better, there's no better way to say it. I just kind of listen to it and appreciate it for what it is. I will say one of my big takeaways from this was I never gave the bass clarinet enough credit in music, because man, the bass clarinet really just kind of they rocked it in a lot of these tracks, which was cool for that. You didn't notice that, but it's just a different, it's apples to oranges comparing it to your straightforward music that's in 95% of what we listen to.
I go back to, I think, the question that I asked when Jason was on the podcast talking about Miles Davis previously, and that is like, do we consider this a live album? Is this a studio album? It sounds a lot to me like they're hanging out and jamming, and you know. Is it repeatable too? You know, there's some questions in my head about, you know, is this, how do we categorize this? And I know jazz is always different, but
well, I think the big difference there is improvisation can be, quote, like a live performance, but you always have that opportunity to tweak it in the studio. So there's always that kind of fallback, safety net, if you will. You don't have that in a live performance.
You're right.
As soon as the note comes out of your mouth, it's there forever, whereas you always have the opportunity. Now, I think that Miles and many other musicians, and certainly in this album and these sessions, were very true to what happened. You know, that I would expect, especially since we know that they did this in only 3 days, there wouldn't have been much time to change it, you know. I think that this is pretty much what they laid down. I didn't dive deep enough to see, you know, was this, how many takes was each track, and sorry for the yawning tonight. How many different versions of each track? I don't know. I didn't go that far. I'm gonna guess not too many. And I think that, you know, Miles was, you know, like I said, he had a big ego, and I think he was really always pushing to be the one to do the next thing, to very, you know, introspective in that way, just trying to, he wasn't trying to please anybody, or this is just my take on it. I'm not, this is not biographical. Just trying to do something new for him and for the people around him, and just explore what this art form could be, which certainly is what this does. It just, you know, going from something like, you know, because it's the other album we've done on this podcast, something like Kind of Blue to this.
Yeah.
It's just totally like from another planet.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you think that there's something about the way that they were creating this that was striving for making people a little uncomfortable? I mean, I remember a few weeks back when we talked with Terry Watson about Sly and the Family Stones, there's a riot going on. And we were talking then about, you know, I kind of wish that I could feel a little bit more of a structure to some of these songs. And Terry sort of pushed back and said, well, I think what they're trying to get you to feel is that sense of there's a riot going on, right? Like, this is meant to make you just a little bit uncomfortable in this moment. Do you think that's what this style of experimental jazz is trying to do? Or is it just friends jamming and pushing the boundaries of what they think music should be?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I can't speak for the headspace they were in when they recorded it, but I get the sense, you know, if I had to guess, I would say they enjoyed pushing the boundaries, right? Doing different stuff, trying to expand, you know, change the genre a little bit, you know, bring something new to jazz, because, you know, his older stuff is all very, you know, in the pocket jazz kind of stuff. You know, so this is a huge, if you listen to Kind of Blue and then listen to this, it's like, these aren't different people.
This
is not the same Miles Davis, right?
No.
Right. So I just think it's a natural progression, like you see it in the Beatles with Sgt. Pepper, which, I mean, is not coincidentally same time period, right? So it's sort of this kind of zeitgeist of psychedelics and you know, we're expanding our minds, man, and we're doing this and we're changing things. And so I think it's fitting for the time period to given whatever style you're in, whether it be the Beatles or Miles with jazz, kind of stretch those boundaries.
Yeah.
A question for you, Nick, other than the awesome bass clarinet, was there any moment or track in particular that really stood out to you that you really enjoyed?
So I'll agree with you, Mike. I really liked Spanish Key. Was the one that stuck with me the most, and for all the reasons that you highlighted. I just think it had a really great groove to it. Just kind of sat nicely and cruised the whole time. It was just easier to listen to, not as challenging as you might say. But I really enjoyed Spanish Key. Right before the end of, I think it was Bitches Brew, there's a moment where it just is total chaos, probably like 2 minutes before the end of the song. And that really kind of caught my attention too. It was just like absolute pandemonium. Everything's just people shredding. And you're just like, what is happening? And then it all just kind of drops out and it's pretty calm. But that was a big moment for me too.
I wonder if, since Spanish Key is more than 17 minutes long, that'll just serve as our placeholder for our favorite tracks playlist here. We'll add that one to it. And come back and enjoy the rest of the album when you've got enough time, but we'll put that one on our SoundLogic favorites playlist.
Yeah, if you're new, that's our playlist on Spotify. And we like to pick two tracks usually for every album. We let our guests pick. This one, we've made an exception. Nick, in terms of this album is now over 50 years old, and it doesn't really sit in you know, the genre of regular pop music. It's back quite far away. But if you think about the relevancy of music, or even just jazz music, how do you think this has aged? You know, what has aged well? What hasn't? You know, would you have a couple of comments on that? And this is a tricky one to do that because it's so different. But how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you're talking about something that's so totally out in the left field, it's hard to say. You know, it wasn't appropriate for the time then, really. So to say where it would stand now, I think it would just be in the same boat, right? Like, it's just this boundary pushing, and it has become kind of a forefather of a whole subgenre of jazz music.
Absolutely.
It opened the door for the fusion stuff and all this, you know, the crazier stuff on the fringes of jazz. So I think it definitely holds up because it's, you know, it's the standard that opened the door for all this stuff. But as far as things, you know, if you're trying to translate it to something current, I would say John McLaughlin's probably the most likely, because it's, you know, it's like a 4-minute piece and it's straightforward and it's there's no, Miles doesn't even play on it, so it's like,
right.
if you want to compare it to what would sit well in today, that's probably just a shorter bite of music, easier to deal with. But I think the whole album probably would stand on its own today, just as it did back when it first was released.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. Usually there's more connections we can tie to pop music, but
right.
I guess for me, you know, in the jazz world, this is still just an absolute pillar. At least in terms of the kind of the jazz fusion, but I think in jazz in general, this is no pun intended, a milestone. that's a different album. Just a legendary album in the jazz world. But still, yeah, it was out there when it came out. It's out there today. Now, this one might be tricky for you, Nick, because it relates to the whole Rolling Stone list. But this is number, what do we say, 85?
87.
I lost. 87. This is number 87 out of 500. Without having a ton of knowledge of everything else on the list, how do you feel about this being the 87th greatest album of all time? Does that make sense to you? Does it seem too high, too low? What do you think?
Boy, I mean, it's hard for me to say. I did a little bit of digging into the list just so I could have somewhat of an informed opinion on it. And lists like this are always so tricky because
you've
got to consider so many things. I think if you wanted to really call it for what it is, I would say you could even swap it with Kind of Blue. That's, I think it was like 39.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know,
so I would say this has probably done more for the jazz genre than that, you know, in my opinion. But other than that, you know, I think it's a fine spot for it, given everything else that's around it.
Not many albums have a beer named after them on this list, and that I feel like needs to bump it up a little higher.
Yeah, that's good. I found it impressive that it was even this high. I mean, yes, it's a legendary jazz album, but compared to everything else around it, it sounds nothing like anything else around it, even anywhere else on the list. It's so different. So I thought that was, but it definitely changed the landscape of music. For sure.
It stretches me like Trout Mask Replica, the Captain Beefheart album did. Like, just like, it is so unlike anything else that is on this list that it just jolts you when you hear it. I think I enjoy this one, and I can have this one on in the background a whole lot easier than I could Trout Mask Replica. But it's avant-garde in that way, that like, this is really going to make you uncomfortable if you're not familiar with this style of music. I too find it surprising that enough people voted for it, supposedly, to have it wind up this high. Maybe I misunderstand just how powerful the jazz world is and how many people will continue to be influenced by experimental jazz like this.
I'm just surprised you compared Miles Davis to Captain Beefheart. I think there's some... some jazz enthusiasts are gonna come to your house with torches.
All right, let's just think about it. If you have this music on, start talking slowly with a gravelly voice. It won't be that low.
Fair enough. Any closing before we get to the end of our time here, Nick? Any kind of closing comments on the album or anything else there?
No. I appreciate you guys having me on, and it's funny the way fate works out to kind of make things cross like this. I'd love That's to sit great. Down and have a beer in person with both of you. One of these
would be great.
I will put in a plug. I sent something to Ben just in an email, since I'm a big Dogfish Head nerd. Sam, who is the brewer, or, you know, founder and, you know, head brewer formerly anyway, of Dogfish Head, he had a series on the Discovery Channel way back in the day called Brewmasters, and one of the episodes was on this beer.
And oh, wow.
And it's an in-depth dive of how they got involved with making it and their partnership with Sony for the re-release of the album. And there's some interviews in there with Miles's family and a couple of the guys that played on the album. So it's a cool episode if you really want to get in the weeds on the marriage between the beer and the album.
It really is.
That's fantastic.
Nick, we can't say enough. Other people can send us free beer, but this is a first to get beer given to us specifically for a SoundLogic podcast episode. It means an awful lot, and it means a lot that you take the time to be here with us on the podcast as well. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers, Nick. Thanks again.
We don't have any more Miles Davis on the list. We used to have an album called Sketches of Spain from 1960. It was on the first iterations and has fallen off of this 2020 list. So this is it, I guess, for Miles Davis, at least for now. Mike, what do we got coming up next?
Well, next we've got album number 88, which is Hunky Dory by David Bowie. We certainly hope you'll join us for that one. Another interesting album. Until
we
then,
just keep pivoting genres.
Yes. Thank you, Nick, again for joining us. We really appreciate it, and thank you, Ben, and for all you listening at home. We hope you continue to be well, take care of yourselves and those around you, and of course, we hope you'll join us again right here at SoundLogic Podcast. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it.
If you like what you hear, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and write a review.
Send us a message at our Facebook page, on Instagram, or through our SoundLogic Podcast Twitter feed. Thanks for listening.